Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. Figure out a way to generate new jobs, that is. And being this is an election year, that's no easy task when the folks in Washington know their own jobs could be on the line. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks so much for joining us on this 201st anniversary of the 16th president's birth. Honest, it's Friday, February 12th. Lawmakers are telling us that creating jobs will be the top priority when they return from the President's Day recess on George Washington's birthday 10 days from now. But those on-again, off-again bipartisan negotiations in the Senate have fallen apart. A frustrated Senate majority leader now intends to bring up a dramatically scaled back bill of business tax incentives for the hiring of new employees. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale sorts out some of the differences over what's the best way for the government to stimulate jobs.
Majority Leader Harry Reid scrapped a bipartisan agreement to spend $85 billion on a wide range of tax breaks for businesses. Instead, he's pushing a $15 billion bill with a limited number of tax incentives for small businesses to hire and retain new employees.
All of these efforts are puny efforts at creating jobs.
Lawrence Michel is president of the Economic Policy Institute. He backs $400 billion worth of infrastructure projects, aid to state and local governments, and extensions of unemployment benefits and food stamps.
This alone would create 900,000 jobs by giving money to people who have a lower standard of living because they've lost their job. They're not saving it. They're going to spend it throughout the economy.
But spending money on social safety net programs is not an efficient way to generate jobs, says University of Southern California finance professor Larry Harris.
Paying people to remain unemployed doesn't get much value from those people. We better to use the money to employ them, at a minimum picking up litter on the sides of our highways.
Harris says the Senate has the right idea, tax incentives for businesses to hire new workers.
Congress ensures that people are only hired if a private employer thinks that it's worth hiring the person.
But Michelle says companies won't hire until they see more demand for their goods, and putting money in the pockets of the poor and unemployed will generate that demand. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Elsewhere on the Hill, a leading Democrat and a key Republican have agreed to work together on financial reform legislation, and they're setting aside the idea of a standalone consumer financial protection agency. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports the new focus is on things they can agree on.
They've been dubbed the Dodd couple. Senator Christopher Dodd, the Democrat who chairs the Senate Banking Committee, and Republican Bob Corker of Tennessee. They want to hammer out a bill that would prevent another financial crisis.
I'm an optimist about financial reform legislation.
Douglas Elliott is a former investment banker, now at the Brookings Institution. He thinks a bill could pass.
And I think it'll do about two-thirds of what we need it to do.
Elliott says a bipartisan bill could give one government agency, probably the Federal Reserve, the job of keeping tabs on financial risks that could threaten the economy. Elliott says banks could be forced to keep more cash on hand, and the bill could create more transparency in markets for complex financial products. The bipartisan effort has its critics.
All show, no substance.
Bill Black teaches economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He says if the bill doesn't include a consumer financial protection agency to police banks and credit card companies,
you're left with a tutu that kind of barely a little bit covers that nothing's been done.
Black also doesn't like the idea of giving the Fed more power. And Douglas Elliott says a stronger Fed could have a hard time popping the next bubble if it's making everybody rich.
It's like trying to tell your teenage daughter not to go out with somebody, but you may not be able to make it happen.
Even if you're the Fed. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And now that age-old question, what's in a name? Turns out interpretation is everything when it comes to trademarks. A Paris court has found that eBay harmed the image of the luxury brand Louis Vuitton. The online auction site has been ordered to pay about $300,000 in damages, and it's supposed to stop targeting consumers on the Internet by brand name piggybacking. Even misspellings of the company's name are verboten. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
eBay has been paying search engines to post ads when Internet shoppers misspell the name Louis Vuitton. The misspellings are sometimes used by counterfeiters to identify knockoffs. High-tech analyst Rob Enderle says France is especially sensitive about fake luxury goods.
The problems with regard to knockoffs have been incredibly costly to those industries, and as a result, the Paris court has stepped up and been very, very aggressive in terms of how those brands are protected.
The European court says that by advertising on a site where people may be shopping for knockoffs, eBay hurt the Louis Vuitton brand and encouraged counterfeiters. But the United States takes a narrower view of trademark protections.
The trademark is not like a patent that nobody else can use it for any reason. In trademarks, what's primarily prohibited is a use which confuses consumers.
Dan Clareman is a law professor at the University of Southern California. He says it's common for companies to target a competitor's market online. Say you search in Google for information about Merrill Lynch. You might see an ad for Fidelity. The practice is so common, Clareman says it's unlikely to confuse consumers.
Many consumers actually find it very useful because if they're searching for one product, they often want to know about competing products.
Analyst Enderle wonders if the European ruling could impact other companies.
Typically, once you have a ruling like this against one provider, that same ruling can be easily translated into other folks that provide similar services.
He says companies like Amazon and Google could be vulnerable, as could any search engine that helps consumers buy counterfeit goods. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Another down day, but an up week for a change on Wall Street. The details when we do the numbers. There are 300 million people in the U.S., a number that is expected to grow significantly in the next 40 years due to immigration, longer lifespans, and yes, people just having 2.3 kids. There's real concern this will put further strain on our social system, especially health care and Social Security. But commentator Joel Kotkin says, don't worry, be fruitful. More people might just be the key to digging out of our economic doldrums.
Right now, America is slumping in one of its deepest fits of gloom. That's thanks to a weak economy, high unemployment, and a mountain of personal and federal debt. According to the latest NBC Wall Street Journal poll, barely a quarter of adults feel their children will be better off in the future, and most think America is in decline. It's easy to get depressed, but I believe America's prospects are far brighter than commonly assumed. The country still possesses many unique and fundamental assets, its deep-seated spirit of ingenuity, a large expanse of arable land, and most important, robust demographics. These traits provide the United States with a reserve power, yet this advantage must be used wisely. Take our population. It will grow by roughly 100 million by 2050, a scary number to some, but I feel that nothing better illustrates the country's underlying vitality than its population growth. Our workforce will grow by some 40%. While other nations, including China, Europe, and Japan, will experience major declines. This growth can drive America's economic resurgence in the coming decades. A larger, younger population is more likely to innovate, start new businesses, and create new domestic markets than an aging one. Yet population growth also assigns great responsibilities. The United States will need more investment in both infrastructure and basic skills training. We will also need to adjust our economic policies to shift capital away from speculation in assets, which dominated the last decade, to new ventures in manufacturing agriculture, and energy. If we could do that, the U.S. by 2050 could remain not only the preeminent country on the planet, but the most diverse, dynamic, and creative society in human history.
Joel Kotkin's new book is The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. If you have a comment for us, the contact link is at marketplace.org. As European leaders haggled over the financial fate of Greece and other troubled nations this week, leaders here at home tried to get in a few economic policies back on track. We mentioned up top Senator Dodd's renewed push for financial reform. President Obama is trying to restart health care talks, and the Fed is gently laying out the plan to raise interest rates again. Joining us for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond is Heidi Moore, writer for Slate's The Big Money. Hey, Heidi.
Hi, good to be here.
Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine. Megan.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start a few days back with the Fed. There was no timeline given, but Chairman Bernanke broke it to the markets gently that he's indeed going to be at some point raising interest rates, tightening the money supply. Good move to lay it all out now in this fashion, Heidi?
Yeah, I think it is. Although, of course, there are already complaints, mainly from Goldman Sachs, which would like him to reconsider the order in which the Fed plans this exit strategy. Goldman would like the Fed to raise interest rates before it starts selling out of major securities like mortgage-backed securities and all of the things that the Fed holds that are really making it easier for banks to do their business without being weighed down.
I've heard of this outfit before. What kind of influence are they likely to have?
Yeah, there's, you know, ever since Goldman doesn't have too many people in the government, they haven't been doing so well in influencing policy. So it remains to be seen.
Megan, it's a good idea to be telegraphing this in the way he has?
Absolutely. I think the thing that Ben Bernanke is now frightened about is not inflation right now, but the fact that once inflationary expectations get established, they can be really, really hard to kill. It's good to establish the expectation that, yes, I'm going to be tightening. I am not going to let inflation get above our sort of traditional targets. They don't have an explicit target, but, you know, they try to keep it in the 1-3% range.
And you get the benefit of playing the Washington game of floating the trial balloon and seeing how it plays.
Yeah, I think he wants to sort of dip a toe in the water and see how people react.
Well, speaking of getting things moving, Heidi, on to the president's plan for a bipartisan health care summit to get the talks going again on some sort of reform. Is there wisdom in this, or is it a desperate last gasp, would you say?
I think both. It's a smart thing to do. But at the same time, why are we seeing this now? Why didn't we see this very early on? And I think it's kind of revelatory of what the administration is seeing on many fronts in terms of bipartisanship and getting people on their side, whether it's Republicans or Wall Street, which is that the White House talks a very, very tough game, but then asks people that it has publicly humiliated to cooperate with them. So if the White House actually wants to put out some verbal olive branches as well as convening a summit, then that'll probably be a step in the right direction.
Or, Megan, could this just be the president's effort to make the Republicans accountable?
Oh, I think he's definitely trying to make the Republicans look like obstructionists. I mean, you've seen this before. George Bush, during Social Security reform, tried to cast the Democrats as the bad guys. They weren't cooperating and so forth. And what happened was the Democrats said, we would love to cooperate with you. All you have to do is throw away your plan and come to us and start over, which is exactly what the Republicans are saying. To me, this sounds completely unconvincing, and I can't believe it works, but it did. And that's because people don't pay that much attention to politics. And what they generally assume is if you can't get bipartisan agreement, it can't be a very good bill. So I think that's sort of one key problem he's facing. And the other is simply that he's running out of time.
Let's just take a quick trip overseas before we say goodbye. European leaders pledged to support Greece, but they've had few details about what they're going to do to unwind the country's economic troubles. More info, they say, stay tuned. What can we expect to happen here, Heidi?
I think what we can see is probably a full Greek bailout that has to happen. And then over time, we really have to consider the problems with the Eurozone at large.
The problem is if they bail out Greece, what they're implicitly saying is, you know, any Eurozone country is too big to fail. This is the question that we're facing here. Is it better to bail people out and create moral hazard and possibly put yourself on the hook for a debt so large you can't pay it in the future? Or is it better to let the first one fail and risk it? And I think they're going to come down on the side that we did, which is do the bailout. But it's not a cost-free choice.
And on that happy and hopeful note. Thank you, Heidi Moore, for Slate's The Big Money, and Megan McArdle of Atlantic Magazine, for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Coming up, a greener kind of white stuff.
It's what we sell, the mountain experience and all of that. And if you go in and destroy it and trash it, then shame on us and people shouldn't come here.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average carved off 45 points, or 0.4%, to end at 10,099. The NASDAQ did edge up 6 points, or 0.25%, to finish at 2183. The S&P 500 fell 2 points, 0.25%, to close at 1075. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P each gained 0.9%. The NASDAQ added 0.3%. China's move to cut back on lending hurt companies that depend on Chinese demand. Investors dented aluminum giant Alcoa by 2.2%. United Technologies shed 1.5%. General Electric dimmed 1.4%. 3M unglued more than 1.3%. Boeing flew off course by about 1.5%. Commodities also fell. ExxonMobil settled down 0.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Nightly Business Report on PBS and its special series on investor psychology, Your Mind and Your Money, Mondays on Nightly Business Report. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Stagebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. U.S. markets enjoy a three-day weekend in honor of President's Day. Upwards of 120 Oscar contenders gather in Beverly Hills for the annual nominees luncheon. And parades and parties continue in Rio de Janeiro during Carnival. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moonen for Kai Ryssdal. All you conspiracy theorists, listen up. Imagine a world where all of us are bugged willingly, and the government doesn't even need a good reason to keep track of that homing device in your pocket. Hollywood keeps telling us it's possible, as in this scene from the movie Enemy of the State.
The government's been in bed with the entire telecommunications industry since the 40s. They've infected everything. They get into your bank statements, listen to your phone calls. Every wire, every airwave. More technology you use, the easier it is for them to keep tabs on you.
Like, say, your cell phone? That was the subject of a court hearing in Philadelphia today, with the government arguing it has no need to show probable cause of a crime to track your cell phone location. Declan McCullough writes about this today for CNET.com and joins us now. And Declan, where are you, or do I have to find that out from the government?
You could, or at least my cell phone provider, but I'm here at CNET in San Francisco.
Okay, so I have this cell phone in my pocket. What can it tell the authorities about where I am and what I'm doing?
It basically is a homing beacon in your pocket that can, if someone is watching, disclose your whereabouts. It knows where it is to a pretty fair approximation. It can be within 10, 20 feet nowadays.
So what is the government arguing that they should be able to do here?
There are kind of two different issues here. The first is what is called retrospective location information. That is where your cell phone has been in the past. Cell phone providers tend to keep this information for about a year, showing what calls were made and where the phone was when those calls were made. And there's also the second question of data showing where you are in the future. In other words, live, moment-by-moment tracking. The DEA was able to use this in Texas to track a car that was driving down the highway. So there's these two separate questions, but in neither case do federal prosecutors think that a search warrant backed by probable cause is necessary.
Well, I'm going to take a wild stab here and guess that civil liberties folks don't like that very much. What's their complaint?
You are correct about that. They're making a twofold argument. The first is that under the text of the federal law that supposedly protects our privacy in this area, judges can require a search warrant if they so choose. Now, this federal law was written in 1986. Nobody anticipated this. The second argument they're making is they're saying that the Fourth Amendment prohibits the government from engaging in unreasonable searches, and trying to find out where Americans are both historically and in the future is an unreasonable search, or at the very least, you're going to need a search warrant to do that.
Well, let me have you consult your internal GPS here and give me your best guess of where this is all headed.
I think what's going to happen in the short term, the courts are going to say that for historical location information, no warrant is required, but for prospective or future tracking, a warrant is necessary. But, and this is the bigger deal here, that in the next few years, we're going to see a new way of looking at the Fourth Amendment. The amount of information that can be gathered because of technology is so immense that this is going to require the Supreme Court to take a hard look at some of its precedents from the 1970s that were created, handed down long before people even thought of iPhones and cellular tracking.
Declan McCullough is keeping track of all this at CNET.com. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tragedy struck just hours before tonight's opening of the Vancouver Olympics. A 21-year-old competitor from the former Soviet Republic of Georgia died on a practice luge run when he bounced off the track and struck an unpadded pole. The games will go on, and in the days ahead, the world will be watching as competitors swoosh along trails where trees and plants have been wrenched from the ground. That's one way of creating a smooth descent, but a new study found it's also the most harmful way to build a trail. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jennifer Collins reports there is a kinder, gentler way.
John Loomis is head of operations at North Star at Tahoe, a ski resort here in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Gentlemen, hey there. Ladies, how are you this fine day?
Loomis has been in the ski business for 40 years.
Do you want me to talk about the old days?
For much of his career, Loomis and most resort operators across the country built ski trails like this.
So you would go in and just bulldoze the run smooth.
It's called grading. The practice shears away soil and plants that keep the mountain environment healthy. Graded runs are most apparent in the summer when the snow is gone.
What we don't want is someone to walk up there and just see this bare scar across the landscape.
A new study out of the University of California, Davis, finds that resorts can prevent those scars if they clear trees and shrubs, but leave the roots in the ground. The clearing leaves behind seeds, and in the spring, those seeds sprout wildflowers that help absorb melting snow and rain. Those plants prevent sediment from gushing off the mountainside, polluting streams and rivers. At North Star, that's important because,
you know, we're the water drinking supply for the city of Reno. They have a real interest in how we do up here.
A few years ago, construction on the California property caused runoff that could taint that water. Violations drew nearly $3 million in fines.
The largest construction-related water quality fines in California history.
Mike Hogan is the environmental consultant who helped the property clean up its act. He says graded runs tend to channel melting snow down the mountain, like a river, and that water takes a lot of sediment with it.
The kinds of things that were happening there probably were happening on almost every other project.
He means in the Tahoe area. The problems, though, stretch beyond the Sierras. Hogan says most resorts in North America, including the ones hosting the Olympics, have bulldozed runs.
I do know at Whistler and Blackcomb, many, if not most, of the runs are graded.
Now resorts like North Star at Tahoe are changing their ways.
Put some
up here.
That's Jennifer Burt, heading out on skis at North Star. She wrote the UC Davis study about graded runs. She wants to see new trails cleared instead of bulldozed.
I think that when any expansions occur or if they're considering grading more runs, that ski areas should really reconsider that process because of the environmental impacts of grading.
North Star is planning three new runs. It doesn't expect to bulldoze any of them. The project will cost up to $7 million. It's 8 times more expensive than building the old graded runs. But Loomis says the resort avoids fines and can market its green practices to skiers and snowboarders.
It's what we sell, the mountain experience and all of that. And if you go in and destroy it and trash it, then shame on us and people shouldn't come here.
In the Lake Tahoe region, I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
If you'd like a look at what graded and cleared ski runs look like below the snow, go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
As we wrap things up on this Friday, let's take a moment to review. Not the major news of the week, but the items that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Rod Abid, senior producer for Marketplace Morning Report. What's your story this week?
It's a lovely Valentine's Day story. A plane arrives in Amsterdam full of Valentine's flowers. Now, it arrives from Bogota, Colombia, so I think you can see where this is going.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So, of course, they checked the boxes, and what do you know? They found tons and tons of cocaine along with the Valentine's flowers.
So that's what those little powder packets are in there.
And you never thought of it that way. That's it.
George Judson, managing editor at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
McDonald's deciding it's time for a new hamburger called the McItaly. They're selling in Italy, made out of Italian hamburger, asiago cheese, artichoke paste, smoked pancetta.
All right, I get it, and a side of McDiamonds, but what is there a problem with this?
Well, the Italians think it's crap. They say it doesn't actually honor Italian cuisine.
The idea, McDonald's doesn't even honor American cuisine.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What's your story?
Well, Opinium Research has just come out with the results of a survey of what annoys people most about work.
Let me guess, number one was having to be at work?
Number one was grumpy colleagues, Brandon, then slow computers and management speak.
Like touching base?
Like touching base, thinking outside the box, blue skying it.
So what you're saying, Stacey, is that bottom line, office jargon was on their radar.
Yeah, apparently it's not a value add and it just messes with synergy.
There's no I in synergy, Stacey.
No, there's not.
There's more of what Rico and Brendan can do on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link on our website, marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 45 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yor. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, what could the lovelorn learn from the banking crisis? That hindsight is 2020.
I didn't realize that setting my price point too high would create a dating bubble that, like the housing market, was bound to pop.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope to see you back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.